Regulations have long limited the amount of alcohol in beer sold in grocery stores and convenience stores throughout the state of Kansas. But those regulations have just been lifted, marking the end of an era. A long era. Limiting beer to no more than 3.2% alcohol by weight was actually part of a compromise that softened prohibition. But where, pray tell, did that very specific percentage, 3.2%, come from? Maureen Ogle, author of a book about beer in America, explains.
Frankly, it's an arbitrary number. There's nothing magical about it.
And yet, for a time, 3.2% beer was a thing, a big thing, mostly for teenagers.
We see 3.2 peak in the 70s. That's a time when, you know, a lot of states had rules that differentiated consumption for 18 to 21 year olds.
States have been letting go of these laws one by one, and now that Kansas has joined the trend, there's only two states left with the 3.2 law. So now 3.2 beer is kind of a relic. And plenty of people are glad to see it go. Here's Jeff Crum of Boulevard Brewery.
It was just a pain in the posterior, you know, for everyone.
That may be. But like I said, it's the end of an era. So here on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to commemorate a time and a place with your stories from the days of 3.2 beer. Call 816-235-2888 with those stories. You can also tweet them at KCURCST. I'm Gina Kaufman here with KCUR's Frank Morris, who's reporting you just heard. Hi, Frank.
Hi, Gina. How you doing?
Good. How about you?
Good.
So going into this story, you had your own experience with 3.2 beer as someone who was a teenager during that peak consumption period.
Right, right. You know, and I think one other thing that is that ought to be stressed here is that it's not just teenagers, because there are a lot of places would only sell 3.2 beer. You know, for instance, I grew up in a town where there was a beer joint and it was just, they only sold 3.2 beer. You know, there was no, because the Kansas liquor laws and liquor laws in a lot of states, as you find out when you start like looking into this stuff, liquor laws across the states, you've seen one state's liquor laws, you've seen one state's liquor laws. They're all over. And so after Prohibition, when states got the ability to like set this stuff up themselves, they set up a crazy quilt of different things. So, and I just got heard from friends out in Western Kansas, where like my uncle, he runs a 3.2 beer joint in, you know, out by Hoisington, and there's no 3.2 beer. He can't even buy it anymore. So, I mean, but yeah, I've had some experience with 3.2 beer.
I'm curious about what you knew about 3.2 beer before you ever started reporting. And then we'll get to what you learned from your reporting.
Boy, well, you know, I mean, this idea, well, I mean, I knew that people got drunk on 3.2 beer, and
they weren't supposed to be able to.
Theoretically, not. Yeah, non-intoxicating beverage, according to this toward liquor control study from the 1930s, that kind of set up the 3.2 standard as a compromise between prohibition and not prohibition. But I grew up seeing a lot of 3.2 beer consumed. Normally sold from pitchers, you know, often in 12 packs from the grocery store. It was always cheap. When I was in college, there were progressive pitchers that would start out at like a dollar and get, you know, for a pitcher of beer and go up a quarter every hour. You know, there was a lot of, I used to go to this place off the wall hall. It was a punk rock venue where every single night, they had a free pitcher of beer. You just had to get there by 6 and you drink free beer for an hour.
And then it gets more expensive as you've already gotten started, kind of?
Yeah, it gets more expensive, like up to like a quarter a cup or something, you know?
Yeah.
So 3.2 beer was, and 3.2 beer was something that it was really super easy for kids to buy, little kids, because, you know, everybody had a, you know, somebody whose brother didn't mind going to the grocery store to pick up some beer for you, you know, so there was an awful lot of sitting around in people's garages, you know, at like, you know, 10, 11 years old, drinking 3.2 beer.
That's pretty wild. So you know, what did you learn about 3-2 beer as someone who was sort of surrounded by it growing up, but working on a story about its demise? What did you learn that you didn't know?
Well, you know, like a lot of people, I guess, who, you know, are surrounded, have been surrounded by 3-2 beer as a thing, I always sort of figured that there must be some reason for that standard. But it turns out there isn't. And, you know, and so you have all these brewers who have to hit that particular standard to in order to access what used to be a really, really large market. Just
like all the states who are trying to hit that standard.
Well, yeah. I mean, and again, you know, it was sort of available to different people and at different places in different states around the country. So, for instance, I believe in Oklahoma, it was they didn't repeal prohibition until the 50s. And then it was mainly 3-2 beer. And so, you know, a lot of places, you know, they used to sell a lot of this stuff, but I never knew that it was just a compromise that somebody kind of really pulled out of their butt, you know.
And, can you imagine people around a table like 4, no 2, no 3.8, no, and like landing on 3.2?
Yeah, you know, and apparently, you know, brewers wanted a little higher standard. You know, beer adds a lot to the taste and the body of or alcohol adds to the taste and the body of beer. And, you know, having to hit a particular standard really kind of curtails how you do the brewing. So brewers wanted a higher standard. Some other people wanted a lower standard. A lot of brewers were already making less powerful beer. Before Prohibition, going into World War One, it was 2.5% alcohol was the maximum you could have in beer. So it was just a mishmash, but the fact that it stuck, you know, it was just a thing to make beer available during Prohibition, but that standard just hung on for 86 years.
Why do you think that is?
Boy, I don't have the first idea, except that it was just the standard. It probably, you know, big breweries started producing it, and it. But I don't know, Gina. You know,
we had an election yesterday, and it is interesting just thinking about it this way, that like once you make a law, it becomes the norm, and then you need like a whole tide to change that law again.
Yeah. Well, you know, and the funny thing too is, you know, people dismiss or, you know, badmouth 3-2 beer, and 3-2 beer is not as tasty as normal beer, but 3-2 beer, you're talking about measuring alcohol by weight, which is kind of a strange standard. Alcohol weighs a little bit less than a lot of the other stuff in beer. When you measure it by volume, it's about 4% alcohol by volume, which is the way beer is normally measured now. And regular beer is maybe 5%. So, you know, you're not talking about a giant difference in alcohol content between...
Just like slightly watery.
Well, it's a slightly different process. You know, it's not like they just add some water at the end. But it's not a gigantic difference. I mean, there are some respectable beers that are less than 3.2% alcohol by weight. They're traditional beers. They're just like low alcohol beers.
Do you feel nostalgic for the 3-2 beer phenomenon that's been, as the Brewers Association, I believe, told you, regulated out of existence?
Not at all, Gina. You know, I mean, I was sort of an early adopter with craft beer. I worked at Free State Brewing Company or at Free State Brewery when it opened in 89. I'm not making beer, but in the kitchen there. But I've been around good beer for a long time. And you know, boy, for us back in the late 80s, you couldn't wait to start drinking something that didn't just seem like a mass commodity. You seem like we were drinking a specific beer with a specific sort of flavor instead of having it just be like air, like just breathing, you know, just water.
You know, we're getting a tweet from one of our listeners who says, going to college in Atchison, everyone went over the bridge to Missouri to get, quote unquote, real beer. There were three dedicated liquor stores inside of the bridge that felt like they were just for Kansas.
Well, you know, there's still on Southwest Boulevard, there's still Don's Liquor on Southwest Boulevard still has this big 5% beer sign. It's just pretty close to the state line. And it's there because it was difficult to get, you know, beer. You know, the beer in Kansas was 4% alcohol by volume, 3.2% by weight. And the beer in Missouri was, you know, 1% higher alcohol. But the 3.2 has always been like second class beer. It's never been the real beer that you want because it had this limitation. And I guess people sort of generally understood it as an arbitrary limitation. Not something definitely not good for the flavor of the beer.
Call 816-235-2888 with your story about 3-2 beer. 816-235-2888. I am really curious about the history behind this, so let's go deeper into that with Jim Sherrow. He's a history professor at K-State, and he is the president of the Kansas Association of Historians. Hi, Jim.
Hey, how are you doing?
Pretty good. So Frank got a history of beer in America when he was working on his story, but Kansas does have its own particular story, right? Because we actually implemented a state prohibition that started earlier than the national prohibition.
Oh, yes, we did. We were leaders in the charge for prohibition, no question about it, beginning in 1880.
So who were some of the players in Kansas pushing for a very early, ahead of the curve kind of state prohibition against the sale of alcohol?
Well, you have to go back to the formation of statehood, actually. The abolitionists who came into the state to make Kansas a free state were not only wanting to get rid of the blight of slavery, but they also had a lot of other social reforms that they advocated. Chief among those reforms were two others. One was women's suffrage and women's rights to their own property. The other one was temperance, which becomes prohibition.
The temperance movement in Kansas was incredibly intense. There's a very well-known figure, Carrie Nation. She did what she called her hatchetation in watering holes throughout the state.
Yes, she was sort of the public face of it all later on. But there were other folks who were very important in this. Drusilla Wilson, who was a Quaker, in fact, an ordained or a Quaker minister, she pretty much led the prohibition movement in the 1870s and was well known for it. She led the whole movement of women who supported temperance and prohibition. And in fact, she's oftentimes called the mother of prohibition in Kansas. So she's a woman who is not as well known as Carrie Nation, but probably in many respects more important.
Because she actually got it through.
She organized and put the pressure on men, because remember, at the time, it was only men who were voting in this state, and over 21 years old. At that. So she was putting pressure on them to follow suit and enact prohibition.
You know, but Carrie Nation is interesting to me in that she was doing her kind of activism at a time when prohibition had already been instated in Kansas. The reason for that being, as I understand it, that there were places selling alcohol despite the fact that it was against the law and doing it pretty openly, and the hypocrisy of it really infuriated her. You know, this law against the sale of booze while all these drugstores and what she called joints openly sold it. And she had personally been married to an alcoholic. She'd suffered from a lack of recourse, going hungry, unable to provide for herself and her children. When you look at it through that lens, temperance being largely a women's cause in Kansas is not entirely surprising.
No, it's not. Her story is a common one, unfortunately. And, even if you go back into your own family histories, you may find instances of this. I have found it in my own family's histories. They're not pretty stories about abusive drunk husbands and the lack of women's rights to deal with those issues or seek divorce or find support in the community. These were really horrible stories. And so this is what led the movement by and large, and particularly put women in the forefront of it.
But so Kansas, that all being said, comes to the national prohibition with a lot of cultural baggage. Do you think that's fair to say?
Oh, yes. Definitely so. And that continues on even after national prohibition is lifted, because Kansas still retains its status as a prohibitionary state until 1948. And even then, you still have laws against, quote, open saloons, liquor by the drink. A lot of clubs then come into existence, private clubs that can skirt that kind of those provisions to a degree.
I want to get back to the private clubs,
sure,
in just a second, because it is
right.
Interesting to me. 1948, this is after World War II has ended. I'm thinking about people who have gone off to fight in World War II, have maybe had access to bountiful alcohol in Europe, and return.
Well, not only in Europe. When I look at my father's World War II photographs, he was in the Navy. He was stationed in Los Angeles, Seattle, Hawaii, the Kodiak Islands. All those places had saloons, liquor by the drink. They became, those young men became quite accustomed to going into a bar.
So does that have something to do with the private clubs that opened in Kansas?
Well, it has something to do with the ending of Prohibition in 48. The veterans, World War II veterans, were not in a mood to be told when and where they could drink. The state legislature had to come to terms with them.
The turning point, though, like the big turning point on this, as I understand it, comes in 1986?
That's right, with Governor Carlin and the passage of the Sin Acts, as they were called.
Can you explain that? What is it that changes in 1986?
Well, I think the way private clubs worked were basically just regular dance halls, liquor by the drink almost, and the whole system was breaking down. And there was a social reaction to all of this, what I consider now to be the nonsense of private clubs at that time. And there was just a change in the air to get this done. And it was passed in 86, as you say. And what was implemented was a county-by-county basis. So counties had to approve it or not approve it. And there are still some dry counties in the state. I think about six of them or so.
Where does 3-2 beer really enter the picture from your standpoint?
Well, I was listening to Frank. I'm hard-pressed to figure this out as well. I think part of it is it was considered, to some degree, and why it was sold in grocery stores, to be a food item rather than, quote, an alcoholic item. And, I mean, there are plenty of items in the store that have alcohol in them, for example, vanilla. And so, in fact, I think vanilla is probably a little stronger than 3.2 beer. And during Kansas Prohibition, and there were some pretty high sales of vanilla.
That's pretty funny. Let's talk to one of our callers. We've got Leo joining us from KCK at 816-235-2888 with his story about 3-2 beer in Kansas. Hi, Leo.
Hey, how you doing this morning?
Good. How about you?
Great. I'm really enjoying the conversation. I grew up in central Kansas, south of Hays, not too far from Hoisington, actually, 30 miles. And we, you know, close to Colorado, we had, that's where Coors was made back in the day when Coors was only shipped to 10 and a half states. But everybody just called it Colorado Kool-Aid. And it was so wide open that nobody made a big deal of it. We could buy warm beer before it was cool, that we could buy it cheaper. And so during the winter, we'd buy the cheap Coors beer by the case and just put it on the hood of our car and drive up and down Main Street till it cooled off. It was just a thing.
And that was everybody not just did. Your car. That it sounds like there were many cars going up and down Main Street with beer cooling.
Yeah. Dragon Main was about the only thing to do in La Crosse, Kansas in the 60s. And so, yeah, everybody did it. I had a 53 Chevy, and I'd buy a case of that warm beer and just put it on the hood of my car and wave to the sheriff as we went by. So nobody thought. Keep in mind, we were real kids, and we had responsibilities that came with that. Well, so we were expected to held to a higher level.
Leo, thank you for that story. This is KCUR Central Standard, and when we return, we'll be hearing from more of our listeners, stories from the days of 3-2 Beer in Kansas. The number to call is 816-235-2888, but do it now. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm joined by KCUR's Frank Morris and K-State historian Jim Sherrow for a conversation about 3-2 beer in Kansas. The state has just lifted an age-old ban on the sale of what you might call regular beer in grocery stores, convenience stores, basically anywhere but a liquor store. But we are remembering a time and place where people drank this 3.2% by weight beer. It was legal, and it was considered too low in alcohol content to be intoxicating. But Frank, remind us, could you get drunk on this stuff?
Well, I've got a scar on my leg, Gina, from playing catch with a muffler right outside of a 3-2 beer joint in Hutchinson when I was about 17. So yeah, you can get drunk on it.
Jim, do you have any such stories yourself?
Oh yes. I don't have any scars from 3.2 beer drinking, but certainly, you know, in the 60s and 70s, 3.2 beer drinking was okay for anyone who was 18. So in Wichita, Lawrence, many other cities, and there were all these 3.2 joints, dance halls, where kids between 18 and 21 would go. And, man, did we have a good time. But if you had a fake ID, then you could probably get in there at 16 or 17 as well.
So people were trying to get fake IDs to be old enough to go to the three...
Not probably, Gina.
Yeah, and there are these storied places at KU, the Hawks Crossing, the Wheel. These are 3-2 beer joints that, you know, people... We're just like generations of I'm sure it's the same in states, 3-2 states around the country where you had this beer. You know, and one other thing I wanted to toss in is interesting. A lot of, I get Oklahoma for sure, I guess also Chicago, they had a separate standard for 3-2 beer. Women, I guess because of the temperance, you know, some of the temperance DNA, women could buy 3-2 beer at 18, but men couldn't. So, you know, for a while, that was the standard in Oklahoma. So it was not, again, carve it up all kinds of ways, accessibility to this this stuff.
Well, let's hear some of our caller stories. We've got Jenny on the line at 816-235-2888. Hi, Jenny.
Hello. Yeah, I just wanted to share, you're just bringing up really good memories for me. When I was, you know, 18 and 19, it was a Friday night ritual that we went over to Kansas City, Kansas. I live on the Missouri side. And we went over to KCK to hit the 3-2 bars, and I met my first love at one of them. So those were the days.
Those were the days. I mean, yeah. I asked Frank earlier if he was nostalgia for the days of 3-2 beer, and he said no. He said he was not. It sounds like you are.
Yeah, I really am. I enjoyed it, and I wasn't a connoisseur, so I really couldn't have probably told you the difference between 3-2 beer and regular beer at the time.
But it does sound like it gave teenagers a place to go, which is kind of a problem today. I mean, it's a problem people talk about a lot, right, Frank?
Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, you know, and after when Congress sort of started punishing states in 1984 for not imposing a 21-year-old standard, you know, 21-year-old drinking standard, there are people who made that argument. You know, like, wait a sec, what are the kids going to do? You know, what about college parties? What about all these? And you know, some people argued it made college drinking worse. However, looked up a little statistic that teen drinking in the United States peaked in the late 70s, early 80s, right at the sort of apex of 3-2 beer sales. So it's you know, it kind of definitely make an argument both ways. But
yeah,
it does seem like 3-2, and God knows how many car wrecks were caused by 3-2 beer.
You know, speaking of which, we heard from our caller who grew up in Western Kansas, mm-hmm. who would go to Missouri. Three liquor stores right across the state line that he felt were probably like really for Kansas drinkers. But driving around with, they bought the warm beer.
Well, so in Colorado, and a lot of places, you could only sell higher alcohol beer warm. That's another one of those crazy.
Super weird. Is that sort of like the same mentality behind a lot of proposed gun laws? Like, well, that'll keep you from doing, like, just in a moment of passion, going and opening your can of beer?
I guess that's it. You know, it's going to be a process. You're going to have to think about this a little bit before you drink it. You put it on the hood of the car or put it in the fridge before you consume it, probably.
Probably. People have consumed warm beer.
Yeah.
That has happened.
Yep.
Dennis on Twitter tells us, as Missouri high school seniors, whenever one of the friends of my group turned 18, we'd make a trip to Shoney's Pizza at 39th and Rainbow to buy our first legal beers. A rite of passage, ? Do you think it was a rite of passage?
Well, yeah, again, you know, I'm from a little town where there was a beer joint. Everybody knew where the beer joint was. And, you know, it wasn't that easy to go in there and just drink because everybody knew you, you know. But, yeah, once you got to be, you know, 18, you could go and sit at the bar with those guys. That was pretty cool.
Let's talk to Bradley in Kansas, who has a proposed answer to some of our questions that we have left unanswered here. Bradley, welcome to the show.
Thank you. If you would allow me, alcohol is always part of the social norms, and social norms mean politics. And the reason that we got 3-2 beer in Kansas specifically is that the legislature had tried to repeal prohibition three times and couldn't get it done. So they had to get a compromise. They didn't have enough votes in the legislature. So creating a quote-unquote non-intoxicating cereal malt beverage that they could pass off as not alcohol and putting that in the Constitution and making it 3-2 by weight, which is a lower number than the actual volume rating, was how they did it. Well, and that's why we got 3-2 beer in Kansas.
Well, thank you, Bradley. And Frank, this is part of the story that you've told.
Right. I mean, that's how you got it nationwide. Because, you know, 9 months before prohibition, you know, Franklin Delano Roosevelt ran on one of his promises was I'm going to get you beer. And in order to have beer under the Constitution, the 18th Amendment said you couldn't have intoxicating liquors. Well, let's classify this as a non-intoxicating beverage. Why? You know, I don't know. But it, you know, if you drink a beer, I guess you can still, you know, go back and go to work or whatever, I guess. But the point is, it's always been an arbitrary standard. It's
the
just
number 3-2.
Yeah, the number 3-2. The whole idea that, you know, if you have beer that's kind of a little less alcohol concentrated than regular beer, well, then that's not really beer anymore. That's the kind of like. Sham.
Jim Sherrow, anything to add here?
No, not really. When you look at
Well, let me jump away from 3.2 beer and talk a little bit about prohibition. In this state, pharmacies could sell their elixirs that were heavily alcoholic in content.
With a prescription, so, right?
Yeah, with a prescription, but those were easily obtained. And so there
was a lot.
You can
see some of the bottles at the Kansas State Historical Society, by the way, with the descriptions of like what these will do for your various ailments.
Oh, yeah. There was one that was sold popularly in the 1890s, which was, I forget what all was in it, but it did have alcohol and opium-based drink called Ladanum. And it was designed for women to confront depression. And as I tell my students, my classes, it worked very well because it just put you right out. And there were all these aspects to it that skirted the intention that the folks who supported prohibition had, and particularly women. And it was one of the things that slowed the right of women to get the right to vote in Kansas was the Democratic Party in the state that vehemently opposed prohibition. Constantly worked against women's suffrage because they said, even in their planks, said that giving women the right to vote, and then probably there'll never be any place to sell alcohol in this state ever, because they were worried about women's support, particularly through the Women's Christian Temperance Union, for keeping Kansas a dry state.
Let's talk to one more caller with a 3-2 beer story from Kansas. Chris in Lenexa, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Gina, for taking my call. I was just sitting here waxing nostalgic as I was listening to the stories. And the gentleman from La Crosse that drove with the case of beer on his hood really reminded me of this one. This was the early 80s. I grew up in Hoisington, Kansas, but most of my family is from Jetmore, which is pretty close to Garden City, close to the Colorado border. And anyway, we would go out to Jetmore on weekends, and we had what we called picnic table parties. So we would put a picnic table in the back of a pickup truck and get like a pony keg of 3-2 beer, and the picnic table riders would just ride around and, you know, drink to their heart's content and wave at the police. Police would stop her once in a while and make sure that everybody was being safe. But it's just amazing to me that we were able to do that, you know.
And that it was coming from a place of trying to restrict drinking and make people safer.
Right, right. Well, and, you know, I'm as a father of drinking age kids now, I am so glad that the laws have changed and people can't just ride around on pickup trucks. As much fun as we had, that people can't ride around in the back of a pickup and drink beer. So
you can't even ride around in the back of a pickup anymore.
Yeah, even without the beer. Yeah. You know, before we go, Jim Sherrow, as a historian, what are the lasting lessons in this story of 3-2 beer and the tensions around alcohol consumption in Kansas? Can this whole saga teach us something now that it's essentially over?
Well, yes, I think one of the main lessons about drinking in Kansas altogether that people really ought to think twice before they start trying to legislate morality, because there are so many ways of skirting around it, and 3.2 beer was one way for younger people to drink. I remember the barn parties that were pretty popular around where I lived, just outside of Wichita, in a little community called Mays, not so little anymore. But it's and the liquor laws in Kansas also contributed to corruption. There was a healthy bootlegging operation in this state. Well, several, actually, and those people made some pretty good money at the time, based on all this desire to keep Kansas pure and moral.
Jim Sherrow with us from K-State and the Kansas Association of Historians. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And Frank Morris, thank you.
Sure thing, Gina.
Frank is KCUR's senior editor and national correspondent. You can get his story on the demise of 3-2 beer at kcur.org. Up next, a children's book for and about kids with autism. Stay with us for that on KCUR's Central Standard. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now I'd like to welcome Jen Bailey to the studio. She's just published a children's book called A Friend for Henry. Henry is a kid who's looking for a friend, but he has certain requirements, right, Jen?
Yes, he does.
Eventually, he meets Katie, but what are his requirements?
Well, he doesn't really want things too loud, too close. He likes things to stay pretty much the same. He needs a quieter friend.
And Katie is that friend?
She is. She knows to come alongside. And if you see in the illustrations, they're kind of parallel playing in the beginning of this of the their interaction.
Parallel play, that's like a term for a stage, something that kids often do where they play next to each other instead of with each other.
Correct. And that helps Henry get a little bit more comfortable.
What is this story really about?
Well, Henry is on the autism spectrum. I have a son with Asperger's. And when my son was growing up, there are some beautiful books out there. I mean, I am a children's author and have my MFA in writing, and I'm aware of those books like Cynthia Lord's Rules and Catherine Erskine's Mockingbird, beautiful books about children on the spectrum. But I wasn't seeing much in the world of picture books. And I really wish that my son had had that early introduction, especially for his classmates, to maybe understand him a bit more.
I mean, you just mentioned that you wrote this for your son. Can you tell me a little bit more about your personal journey as a mom raising a child with Asperger's?
Well, sure. So my son, Harris, he's the middle of three boys. He just had a tougher time. We weren't aware of his diagnosis until we moved here. Actually, we had lived in the Washington, D.C. area, and we moved here when he was in third grade. And the Blue Valley School District was just magnificent. We figured it all out. We figured what was going on. But he had a rough time of it. He was frequently labeled by his peers as, well, he's the weird kid, he's the shy kid. And I think if they had understood him a bit more, it might have been easier.
I know this is like a challenging thing to talk about sometimes for some parents, but can you talk about your own personal journey through your own understanding of what your son was dealing with? Because I have noticed, it seems to me that children's books are also for parents.
They certainly are. And so I guess what I was looking to do with this book, it was very important that I show this from Henry's point of view. I actually had gotten advice, well, make it from Katie's point of view, show what his friend sees. Well, that's what we're all looking at when we look at a child on the spectrum, is we're looking at them. And I wanted to be able to look through their eyes. I wanted that opportunity for people to understand. You know, he had a rapid-fire mental process going on when he was trying to come up with a way to connect with somebody. And I thought if...
Can you describe that process a little bit more? Because our listeners haven't necessarily read the book.
No, you're right. I'm sorry.
No.
So what I mean by that is when he meets somebody, when Henry meets somebody, he's trying to categorize them. So, for instance, when he meets Vivienne, she's Clackety Shoes and she's Rainbow Colors and she knows all the pony songs. And he would be going through, he goes through this process of, where do I connect? How do I reach out to this person? So frequently, what another child might see as just this odd statement or this random comment is actually the way that Henry, or the way that my son in this case, had figured out, well, if I say this to them, maybe we can bond that way.
He paints rainbows on Vivian's shoes, if I remember.
He does.
And she's not thrilled.
No, but she had liked rainbows. she had rainbow-colored fingernails. And when he asked her, well, when I get paint on me, I wash it off. And she said, oh, no, it's beautiful. And then he wondered, well, isn't painting on people against the rules? And she didn't seem to mind. So he thought he could reach out to her that way. And it didn't quite work.
Did you worry at all? I mean, it was important to you that this story be from Henry's point of view. Did you worry that as close as you are as a mother of someone on the spectrum, that you might get it wrong trying to get inside the brain of a person with autism, trying to tell that story from their perspective? Did you worry about that?
I did. I mean, you know, I truly believe in own voices books, and I realize that I am not a person on the spectrum. And so I didn't write this when my son was very young. He's now 22 and he's doing beautifully. And we spoke a lot about this story. And I asked him before I came here if he was okay with me coming. And he's still, he's fine. So it was really important that I listen to him and I try to understand what his process was. So that's kind of how I went about it, that I thought if we can show you, but once again, you meet one person on the autism spectrum and you've met one person.
Right.
It just like all of us. And so it was really to show that, you know, it's just the same when we meet anybody else. We need a little patience. We need a little understanding.
So you went through this process of kind of consulting your son on the book. Is there a moment where you learned something new about him through that?
Well, there is. And part of it was this thought process that what was going on for him, that it wasn't just a let me look at this person and figure out. I feel that a lot of people on the spectrum have very high sensitivity to sensory issues. My son has told me that he does. And so he's not just looking at what they do, but as you can see in the book, he's noticing how they sound. Katie smells like strawberry milk, and he's kind of thinking, well, they do this, but I do this. So that was part of it, was that it's not just do we like the same things? There's a lot of other factors that went into his process.
Yeah, I had not thought. I mean, I've learned some just about autism as a person who is living in the world today because it's such a bigger part of the public conversation. But I had never thought about, as a child, the things that people with autism are often sensitive to are behaviors of children a lot of times. Lots of noise, lots of chaos, lots of not following the rules.
That's true. And let's face it, schools, life are really geared toward the extrovert. That's who gets the prize. You know, there's a person who's willing to step up, the child that's willing to be charming.
Class participation points.
Yes, exactly. And so in a way, that's why this book never mentions in the text that Henry is on the autism spectrum. It wasn't because I wanted to preclude it, but I wanted to increase the children that might see themselves there. For the shy child, the introverted child, this really is for any child who finds it difficult to step up and to try to look for that friend.
Talk to me about the larger response you've gotten to this book, A Friend for Henry.
It has been really amazing what has happened with the story. I've received tweets and notes on my Facebook page of parents. I mean, people probably my age. I had one woman who just said, I never knew the hole that had been in my life until this book filled it. I had another mom whose son was going into high school and she bought it for him before he started his next semester. And she said, you know, we're never too old to be able to see ourselves in a story. And her son was on the spectrum, but mainstreamed as my son was, so probably more with Asperger's. And it's truly been amazing. I had a second grade teacher so thrilled that the book came. So I did send one to that child in that class because they read the story while she was out as a young girl. And everybody in the class was like, oh, this is so-and-so. This is, now I understand why she was mad when I did this. And it's been truly lovely. I'm really grateful that people are noticing it, and hopefully it will help.
You know, as you mentioned, you are a mom who wrote this book for your son, inspired by your son. You are also generally a children's book author. How did you get into that?
I am. I'd always loved story. I come from a family of storytellers. And so it took me a while. As I said, while I was writing some other books, people would be like, oh, well, you need to write about your son. And I simply couldn't. I was too close to it. But once I got a little bit further away, it was good. So I just love the idea of stories, and I really love the idea of writing for children.
What did you love about that idea in particular?
Well, I think that children are so much more open to possibility, to dreaming, to imagination. And it was just, they're the audience that I wanted to reach, not didactically, but just to come alongside and to share those wonderful moments.
Come alongside is a phrase you have used twice now. I'm curious about what that phrase means to you.
Well, I guess it means to share a journey. Not to dictate, not to say this is how we're going to go about this, but to truly share an experience and to say, this is what I see, what do you see? And I see it as a conversation. I see picture books as a conversation. They are, in their purest form, it's a chance for a child to sit in the lap of a reader or sit next to a reader and to share a conversation. So I always love a picture book that opens that discussion.
Is there a moment in this story that feels very close to something from your own experience that you'd be willing to share?
Well, I'll tell you, first of all, Mika Song did the illustrations, and they're
beautiful.
They are exquisite. I could not have asked for somebody to do more. And the way that she captured Henry, you know, there's a spread in the beginning where he's standing pretty much, he looks alone in his classroom, but he's not. But all the children around him are moving about and getting ready for their day. And he's standing there very still. And this I really am grateful to Mika for, that it's hard to have a quiet hero in a story. And yet she did that with these illustrations. She captured so much of what was going on. And my favorite picture in the book, and one, as you said, that speaks to my experience, is when Henry and Katie kind of get to know each other through the fishbowl, through Gilly's fishbowl, and having that filter almost.
I love the fishbowl. Okay, so when he becomes friends with Katie, Henry becomes friends with Katie, they're looking together at a fishbowl and talking about the fish. And I really love that moment as a grown person, remembering that you can connect with people about a third thing.
Yes, yes.
And like, it's not about what I'm saying about me or what you're saying about you. We can both be looking at a fish.
And it really is just that kind of moment. My son has a little dog named Scout, and when we got that dog, we realized that this would be his connection to other people. Other people would see this adorable dog, Scout, and they would be drawn to her, and through her, he might be able to better connect.
You know, you said just a moment ago that it's hard to have a quiet hero. Do you think that that is part of why our society rewards the extrovert?
I think that's a fantastic question.
Because if we've all grown up on these stories of the heroic extrovert.
Yeah, yeah. And we're always, in story, you are looking, there's a quality called agency, where the hero needs to make their own decisions, and they need to drive the story forward. And so when we think about that, well, the way that we drive a story forward is through action, it's through adventure, it's through taking risks. But there are other ways to do it, too, and they're quieter ways. It's just a harder push, I think, and I think it's also a harder sell.
Can you talk just a little bit more about what you have learned through the process of writing this book, A Friend for Henry?
Well, there's always more to say or more to edit. I'll tell you, I've written this story I don't know how many times. It took me a number of years to get it just how I wanted it. And even after Chronicle picked it up to sell it, there was still edits to do. And we worked on that ending for a long time. We wanted to get it just right. So if there's anybody thinking about becoming a children's book writer, I would sincerely say to them, think long and hard. I mean, do your revisions. In a picture book, every word counts. So you've got to think about every single word. And so you've got to make sure that they are really the right word, the best word for the story.
Can you read the very end?
Oh, I certainly can.
This is spontaneous, but we're going to go out on the very end of this book because You got it. You worked hard to get this.
I worked hard to get this. And so Katie and Henry have decided that he doesn't particularly care for swings for slides. And she is not a big swing fan, but they've built a tower together and it's perfect. And the next day they played on the swings and Katie went down the big slide. Henry waited at the bottom for his friend.
Our time is up. Jen Bailey, author of A Friend for Henry, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you. I really appreciate the time.
Jen Bailey is a local author who wrote a children's book for her son who has Asperger's. He is now 22 and doing great, and he approves his mom talking about him. If you tuned in late and didn't catch the whole story, it'll be online by the end of the day with all our other past shows and conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, modern monetary theory used to be considered kind of a fringe take on economics as part of the heterodox line of thinking that UMKC's economics department has notoriously espoused. But now that prominent politicians are talking about it, is it becoming mainstream or not? That's tomorrow on KCUR's Central Standard. This show is produced by Melody Rao with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman.